Some of the views expressed on the Mormon Channel are solely for the education and inspiration of our audience and may not represent the official position of the Church.
For members of the Church, education is not merely a good idea, it's a commandment. We are to learn of things both in heaven and in the earth and under the earth. Things which have been, things which are, things which must shortly come to pass, things which are at home, things which are abroad.
Everyone at one time or another has sat in a classroom to receive some type of instruction, whether it's formal education, seeking certification, or even sitting in a Sunday school. There is a teacher and there is a student. Invariably, that teacher will use some method in instructing and evaluating the class. Welcome to Insights. I'm Marilee Stallings. The term instructional technology is not exactly a household phrase. So if you don't know what it means, we have with us today Professor Nick Eastman with the Utah State University Instructional Technology and Learning Sciences Department to help us understand it. Nick, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, I found this definition in Wikipedia. Instructional technology is the theory and practice of design, development, utilization, management, and evaluation of processes and resources for learning. I'm not sure I understood that when I read it. Do you understand it?
Well, I've read quite a few similar statements, and they try and put in the kitchen sink. But essentially, they're looking at ways to help people learn more effectively and using whatever ingenious technology is available at the time. So right now, there are things happening on the World Wide Web that are pretty amazing. And that would just be one of many different ways that instruction gets delivered. I just came from a presentation where they talked about advanced distributed learning and how the military is quite interested in that. And to me, distributed learning means instead of sitting in a classroom, you're probably in a at a computer console, and you're probably going through some instruction that somebody's put together for you. And if the person uses the principle of instructional technology, they'll do a much better job than if they just wing it. So,
you know, when you talked about using technology in a classroom, all of a sudden it dawned on me that at one time the chalkboard was new technology in a classroom. And of course, it's still being used today. It maybe has morphed into a whiteboard, but
there's some things called a smart board, which my wife's actually more alert to than I am because she supervises student teaching. But there are ways that teachers can record what it is that they're presenting, that they can do something like a PowerPoint demonstration on what looks like a chalkboard, and they can interact with their class in some unusual ways, including having animation or other fairly advanced graphic kinds of things. So anyway, the lid's off as far as getting people to use different technologies, and it seems unlikely that anything's ever going to go back into the box that it was before. I was reading in a book last night by Sherry Dew. It's the biography of Gordon B. Hinckley. And in 1936, he came back from his mission, which had been in England, and with the express purpose of trying to help develop some missionary discussions that could be recorded and then shared around the world. And as I read about it, I thought, he was doing instructional technology. That's exactly. And he had an English background and was quite skilled as a writer, which I'm sure helped him a lot. But the problems are the same, trying to help people understand and where you can use pictures. Sometimes that's fantastically better than just describing things for people. So,
you said that you had been here at Utah State University since 1974. Did I get that correctly?
Yeah, that's right.
How did you get involved in this particular field of study?
seems like things always happen in ingenious ways. But I had gotten a master's degree in elementary education in a thing called the Teacher Corps. It was back in West Virginia, and went to Ohio University for the degree. And when I got out, I really wanted to work for a consulting firm in Salt Lake that was an educational consulting firm that my dad had put together. I ended up spending a couple of years in the military, including 1 year in Italy, which was incredibly fun. And I was married by then. But I came back, went to work for this consulting firm, and also got into a doctoral program at the U of U. And, well, the economic downturn, this isn't the first time that's happened the way it is right now. And when that happened, I went looking for something else, and something came up at Utah State. And my first job was as an evaluator in a program called Instructional Development in the Merrill Library and Learning Resources Program, which the library is still there, and there's a similar office now. But it got my foot in the door, and then after a few years, I moved over and became part of the faculty at what was then Audiovisual Services, but then went to Instructional Technology, still with the same kind of an idea, and that was, how can we design instruction to be really effective? How can we take advantage of the possibilities from film or from video or from graphics and help the learner see things more clearly and help the learning process work better? So that's really what we're about.
So doing more than just putting a diagram up on a chalkboard, what more can we do? What's out there that can help us really bring this to life?
Well, one of the fun things with the computer is that now things are interactive. And so it's possible to set up a simulation. And I have a number in the classes that I'm teaching that ask students certain questions. You can come in with streaming video and talk for a couple of minutes about, this is what I'm hoping you'll get out of this exercise. Here are the main questions. But then to have it an interactive sort of thing, so it's a lot more demanding on the student than just sit back and listen. And hopefully to help the person be more reflective and more thoughtful about what they're processing. And for a long time, I was very interested in foreign language learning. And I just think that the computer opens so many doors for that, because you can have authentic speakers recorded. You can listen to natural language. You have to be a little careful that it doesn't just come at you so fast that you can't, like drinking from a fire hose, you know.
You get blown off into the next block.
So there are limits to what you can process, but it certainly is superior to the days when you had to sit in class and have somebody say the word and then you repeat it. And then spend a lot of time while other people are having the one-on-one attention. And so there's just so many more things that are possible. It's incredible.
Well, going back to 1974, I was still in high school. And there were no computers in the classroom. There was a computer class that students could take to learn about computer programming. And they had the big bulky cards with little punch holes in them. So
how do we get from there to here?
How do we get from there to here? It's really different now.
It is really different. And there have been a lot of things that have happened. I was thinking of calculators that came into effect at the time I was doing my doctoral dissertation. But when I had my first statistics classes, you had to do everything by hand. Well, when you could do it on a calculator, you could save hours by just plugging in formulas and making things happen. Well, and that was just the beginning. I mean, the idea of a spreadsheet and the idea of the personal computer that came in. And for most people in the early 80s, but they were there before that.
I remember the 8-inch floppy disk.
Yeah. And they really were floppy, too. Unlike some other ones that they called floppy disks but didn't bend at all. So anyway, we've seen a lot of differences in the ways computer process and also the incredible capacity. You know, here we have the flash drives that we have that might have a gigabyte's worth of memory on them. And I mean, that's so much more than those first computers had.
Yes.
So just anyway,
thinking about it.
Yes. There have been a lot of steps along the way and they just keep multiplying. So it's hard to tell what's coming next. But the distributed learning over the internet to me is really exciting. And you can just do things that are revolutionary. I remember when my father saw this online class that I teach for the first time. He's been gone almost 5 years now, but he looked at that and he said, that is going to revolutionize higher education. That is really different. And I think he was right. I think it is revolutionizing. Most of the classes now on the USU campus have a component that we would call a course management system, where students submit their assignments. They have discussion boards where they can post questions or they can post their opinion after they read a particular topic. And when they want to see their grades, there's a grade book. So you go in and you can see, well, this has been graded, but this one hasn't, or here's my average right now. I wonder what I ought to do to change that. And those are for the on-campus classes. You also have these distance classes like the one I'm teaching with 40 students teaching about educational research. That one, they just log on when they're ready, and there's a series of lessons that they go through. They're simulations, and I try and focus them on a particular problem I'd like them to wrestle with. And then they read about it. They might see some videos that are posted. And then they're responsible to go through and answer certain questions that lead them toward designing a research project.
So this is all online.
It's all online. And that means if they want to sit there in their jammies at 2 in the morning, they can click on it and Nick Eastman will talk to them for 3 minutes through a
pre-taped video.
Pre-taped video. I don't want to be up there at 2 in the morning to do that. But it really is amazing that all the things. And, you know, they'll go through and finish the class. And at the time of graduation, some people will go through the line and say, you know, I really enjoyed your class. They know me because they've seen me, you know, 60 times giving presentations. But I might know them if they came in and did the online advising now, because we do have a way that if they have a video camera, I can see and we can just talk like we're talking face-to-face. But sometimes, you know, they'll say, you're one of my favorite professors and you never even met me. And you'll say, well,
I hope that isn't why I was your favorite professor.
Yeah, it could have been. But it's amazing to have people express their opinions and take positions and argue for this, that, and the other. Or in the class, they all have at least one and sometimes two assignments as a moderator. So they're the ones that post the questions and they run the discussion. And if it goes in a direction they don't want it to go, they ask another question and change it back a different way. And the thing that's so unusual, this isn't happening in real time. This is happening asynchronously. So one student posts at a certain time and another student comes in and comments on the posting, but it might be 24 hours later or 3 minutes later. And as much as possible, I like the people to interact on the threaded discussion board because everybody can see what we talk about. Whereas if they send me an email and want kind of a private answer to their question, well, the trouble is nobody else learns from what they said. So anyway, it's a different ballgame. It's really different to teach this way.
You know, we talk about what's happening in the classroom today, and I think about what's happening in businesses, you know, because they also have instructional learning that they have to be doing in their businesses. And have they fed off of each other?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much. And I'm struck with how many of our graduates, we just had a kind of a reunion of people who are out working. And a lot of them are working in a situation with what we'd call distributed learning or distance education. And, you know, they're designing ways to teach. Here on this campus, if you want to take a car from the motor pool, they don't want you to take it until you've gone through a safety briefing. Well, they used to do the safety briefing, you know, at a certain time, somebody would stand up and talk to you. Now it's on the computer. You go in, and when you're done, you run through a quiz. And if you get a certain score, they certify that you're ready to go out and drive a car. And the same thing, if you're going to do research, they have a four-hour, it's about a four-hour exercise with human subjects. So you've got to demonstrate that you're aware of ways that you could step on people's toes and that you're smart enough not to, that there's some things that you can do that will save you embarrassment and them discomfort and the university lawsuits. So, you know, they have a whole bunch of ways. But they're using that that idea of learning over the computer.
I think they call it e-learning.
Yeah.
Yeah, e-learning.
Let me just describe one other classroom, because this has pushed me as much as anything that I've taught since I started my career. One of the things that it underlines is that the days when you could just handle your teaching and everything would be fine, it was you and the students in the classroom pretty much on your responsibility, those days are past. It isn't like that. Here's an example. I'm teaching a class that we would call a blended learning class. We meet. It's a three-semester-hour class. We meet once a week for about an hour and a half. And I have some of the students in the class with me. That'd be about six to eight, typically. I have 20 in the class, so that means there are at least a dozen who either can watch it in real time as it's happening, and if they want to ask questions, we have a thing called Wimba that they can send me a written question that I can look at. But let's say they have a job that doesn't allow them to be available at that time. The class is recorded. I have a teaching assistant that runs a video camera. It's recorded and posted so that they can watch it from their computer at whenever it's convenient for them. And I require that they see that each week. In addition to that, we have these threaded discussions. So a lot of the things that we used to always discuss in class will happen over the threaded discussions now. But there are some things that are best handled in the class. I have two projects going, one for Toys R Us. We're evaluating some of the training that they do for their new employees, which is kind of a neat opportunity. And then there's another group. There's 10 in each group, basically, but they're researching what we call service learning. And they're interviewing faculty, students, and members of the community to come back with a kind of a reading on how service learning is going at Utah State. And they're doing it as a class project, but it's going to end up being valuable for the service learning center here on campus, we hope. So in addition to having class exercise, we've also got a benefit that pays off for somebody else. That's service learning.
Thank you for joining us on the Mormon Channel. You're listening to Insights, where we are discussing instructional technology with Professor Nick Eastman at Utah State University in Logan, Utah. Now, with instructional technology, we're talking about the technology that's used in instruction. But you sent me an article that you had written for The Religious Educator, which is a journal for seminary and institute instructors, titled Beneath the Surface of Multicultural Issues. And I really liked this article. It was very low tech. It was what you were talking about. What got you thinking about the topic for this article?
Good question. It's always hard to know when something started. It just depends on when you pick up the thread.
Built and grew.
Yeah. In 1996, my wife and I and two of my sons went to the Republic of South Africa. We spent a year on sabbatical there. And I worked at what was called a technicon. It was called the Border Technicon in East London, South Africa. And after I came back, I just thought it would be fun to teach a class that would compare things in the United States with situations in South Africa, particularly along the lines of race and communication issues. And so I proposed that to the honors program. They said, go for it. And so I taught the class about four times, once a year for a while. Then I went on another sabbatical. This was involved Mauritius.
Mm-hmm.
I told you a bit about that. And since that time, I've taught the class twice. The class changes a little bit, but it's pretty much the same idea. And in each case, the formula was to, as much as possible, take the students into the context of South Africa, let them see what apartheid was all about, let them wrestle with some of the tough issues that South Africa had. And then about midway through the term, after they were a little comfortable with that, turn back to the United States and say, you know, those problems aren't just South Africa. There's some problems here that you might want to think about. And wow, I'd have a lot of people say, I had no idea that stuff went on in this country. You know, I thought civil rights was something that happened in the 60s and we're done with it. And wow, you're telling me that there are still elements in our society that aren't accepting, aren't willing to work very well with the diversity that's out there. How do we deal with those? So that's the class that got me started. And then being in Mauritius, I had seen a video that Steve Covey did, which is actually really well done and a very insightful video. And it talks about a lot of lessons that we could learn from Mauritius about race and communication issues. And anyway, I really applaud Covey's group for having done that. But when I went, I shared some of the things from that video with some of the people that I met in Mauritius, and they said, yeah, that's the view of Mauritius we'd like everybody out on the outside to see.
The ideal.
Yeah, that's our ideal. And as I was there for 3 months and came to know quite a few people and got to talk about some of the issues. And yeah, they have their own set of problems, but essentially the things that Covey talks about are true. And that is that, you know, it's a country that has a very low crime rate. The police don't carry guns. The students in schools are, you know, there's a high level of literacy. And even though it would seem like it'd be a poor third world country, it really has seen a lot of growth because of people rallying and being able to work together. And they have five different ethnic groups that are very, very different, but there's a sense that, you know, we need the people from the other communities, that they're important and their way of life's important to me. And my life would be impoverished if I didn't know about the Hindus or the Muslims or the Chinese and just how they run their lives. So even though I don't necessarily want to join that community and be part of it in the sense of being a participant, I can appreciate what they do, and I can learn some lessons from how they do things.
I thought it was interesting you pointed out that the island of Mauritius, when it was discovered by European Dutch traders, it was uninhabited. Nobody was living there. So that maybe that was an advantage. No one could claim first rights. No one could call you a conqueror or, you know, you know, or anything like that. So what's the basic history of this island?
Yeah, it's a really interesting place. The Europeans know more about it than Americans because it's really not on our radar as far as a vacationing place. It's at exactly the same latitude as the Big Island of Hawaii, and it is very much like one of the Hawaiian islands in being really a tropical paradise. It was a volcanic origin for the island. It's about the size of Cache Valley.
And not very big then.
It's not very big. 1.2 million people on an island the size of Cache Valley. And lots of parts of the island are volcanic and not really inhabitable. So you have a ring of hotels around the outside and some really beautiful beaches. And then you have different waves of people that came into the island. And the Dutch were there for a time, and everybody knows about Mauritius as the place that the dodo bird lived and went extinct. Most people don't connect up that that's where that was, but that's where it was. And that, because it was uninhabited by humans, that's why the dodo could do as well as it did. And there were some really large turtles that also went extinct about the same time. But within about 70 years, it was discovered by the Portuguese, but the Dutch were the ones who colonized it first. And they had pretty much wiped out the dodo and taken the ebony forests out and so forth. And they basically left it. And then the French came in and occupied for another 150 years. And they're the ones that introduced slavery and sugar cultivation. And eventually, after slavery was abolished, well, the British came and took over the island. And then they abolished slavery. Then there was a system of indentured workers that came from India. And so large numbers of Indians would come, work for 5 years, get their passage paid for, and then stay and set up their own life. And so something like 70% of the people who live on the island are originally from India because of this pattern of indentured servants. But the result is that you have Hinduism, you have Islam, you have Chinese, and some people called Franco-Mauritians, who would be the French that came originally, and then British, because the Brits basically controlled the island for 150 years before the country was made to a republic and is pretty much self-governing. But anyway, it's a really interesting place, and it's an interesting experiment in ethnic diversity and how you get people to live alongside each other and tolerate differences and help each other.
Now, I think I wanted to talk about this or bring this out because we do have a rather multicultural audience. Most of our listeners are members of the church, but we also have other listeners, and we're listened to around the world. And so I was very much intrigued by this whole idea of multiple cultures and getting along and how they interact. What were basically the positive things that you did see when you were in the Mauritius Islands?
I guess one of the things that started to come out pretty clearly was an appreciation for other cultures and a little bit of an inviting people to participate. So I think we were invited to a Hindu wedding, and we weren't able to attend, unfortunately. But we were given access to a lot of different people and their way of life. And you had the feeling that that was common, that people often would be invited to participate in this Hindu festival.
It felt friendly.
Yeah, it's very welcoming. And, you know, this isn't necessarily going to bring you into being a practicing Hindu, but at least when you finish, you'll know more about why people do the things the way they do. And you'll come away with a basic respect. And I think that's one of the things that I'd like to see more of in our country. There are some practices in different cultures that we could frankly learn from. There's some things that we could, let me give an example. My wife and I were invited to spend some time in Turkey on a cultural trip. And some of the hospitality that we experienced there was just rather remarkable. Inviting us to people's homes for dinner. We stayed overnight with some people. We got invited to schools and saw presentations and so forth. But I think that sometimes in our community here, there's a toleration for people that are different, but there isn't a lot of appreciation. Sometimes they're not very much respect. We have a problem sometimes in university classes that a person speaks with a foreign accent, they may not be listened to as well by other members of their group. Just not because they aren't smart, not because they don't know what's going on, but because people have a prejudice against listening to a foreign accent. And they may not even know that they have it. They just kind of turn off their attention when somebody starts speaking. And one of the things that I've tried to do in my department, and I don't know how successful it's been, but I've worked on it as long as I've been here, is to try and have an international night where you invited people from different cultures to come. And we do it as a potluck, and they bring something, a dish from their country. And if you're from Idaho, you're supposed to bring a potato dish.
Funeral potatoes.
Yeah, that's a Mormon. But it's kind of fun to meet people in a setting where you celebrate the uniqueness of what they do. So I really believe in that. And I think I can relate to it. I've been an international student myself. I've studied in French. I've studied in Canada. I've studied in France. And I'm trying to learn Spanish. So, I mean, there's no limit to what you can learn and how far you can reach out. But as much as possible, I like to see that become part of the way people think about other cultures. Not just, you know, we got to tolerate those people. You know, they're here. But, hey, they've got some good ideas. You know, I like the taste of that salsa. I wonder how they did that. You know, something like that.
Well, I think, too, that we're, as a culture, we're becoming increasingly more and more cultural because it's so easy for people to move from place to place. We have airplanes and cars and people are on the move. And this has been going on since the beginning. People don't like it here. They'll go over there. And so I think we do get a lot of this real multicultural, and it's not just here in the United States. It's in a lot of different places that they have that. So by studying these multicultural issues, how has that helped you as a teacher?
Let's see. It's useful to think about how to reach out and try and help some of the students that maybe come from another country and might have some difficulty adjusting. In our department, we typically get students from, some from Korea, quite a few from China. We've had recently a couple from the Dominican Republic. And
that's here in Cache Valley.
Oh, yeah, that's right here at Utah State.
You think of some of these other larger cities, and it's even more so.
Yeah, for sure. I think that our student body is about 8 to 10% international students here at Utah State. So you really do see a large contingent from a lot of different countries. And the countries sometimes change. You know, in the 60s and 70s, Iran sent a lot of students to Utah State because of the agricultural programs that were applicable. And then after Khomeini's arrival, that has completely stop, but we've had other international groups have come. Let's see. I guess the one of the things I wanted to mention was that I haven't done this for a while, but there was a time when I had read about a model for helping students who were studying in a second language in your classroom, and it was called sheltered instruction. And the idea was that in addition to them coming to your class each week and participating just like the other students, that you had an additional kind of like a supplementary class that you'd hold for them. And I remember discussing with the faculty, and some people said, well, let's be honest about this. If you're going to put extra work into it, this needs to carry credit. So I had a one-credit hour class, and we would meet in a little seminar, and usually it was about six or seven students plus me, and sometimes we just did it over lunch. But we'd talk about the cultural differences and about some of the vocabulary that would be new to them and some of the expectations that might be different than what they were used to in the teaching that they'd received before. And I found that to be really a fun exercise, and I got to eat lunch somewhere, so I might as well be with those students. But I think that was one of the ways of becoming a little more sensitized to what these other students were experiencing, and it was not always positive. You know, it's a real tough thing to come in and listen for 8 hours a day to somebody speaking in a language that's different than you.
Absolutely.
You go back with a pounding headache.
So any kind of help that you can give them, encouragement, not only just encouragement from class members as well, but even if they're computer savvy, any helps that you can give them with some of the technology that's available.
Yeah, that can be really helpful. And a lot of the times those are the students that know some tips that help me. I mean, I'm frequently learning from the students in my class how to make some things work in ways that I don't know. I guess one of the other side of it, though, you know, I was talking about from the standpoint of the student, the international student, but from the student in class, I think it's really important to rub shoulders with people whose language is different than yours and who can relate to the world in a little different way. We have an advantage here, and that is that we have a lot of people who are returned missionaries from the church who've spent time in another country, speak another language, know what it's like to operate in a foreign language setting, and sometimes are fairly sophisticated about what things are like in a different country in ways that would not be the case in other places in this country. We had a project going with Brazil, and our partner back in Georgia, when he visited here at Utah State, and he just said, "I can't believe the language capability you got here in Portuguese." He said, "I can't find anybody who's even willing to study back there." And he said, "You got 500 or 600 people on this campus who speak really good Portuguese, and you know they can crack jokes in the language, and they understand the idioms and so forth." So there are some hidden advantages. There's some hidden disadvantages, though, and that is that by the time people come back from their mission, they're not particularly able to take time to go do cultural things abroad. They need to buckle down, get their degree, get married, raise their family, move ahead because they feel a bit behind in terms of their own development clock. And so we found that it was actually harder sometimes to get people able to go take international experiences than it might have been somewhere else, even though they might have the language, which is a tremendous advantage. But, you know, they also we have a lot of married students on this campus.
And that's now a priority.
Yeah. I mean, you got to keep the family fed. And can you take your whole family to go to France? Well, we got one of our students who did, but it's more the exception than the rule.
I think then it's, you know, just taking a look at these multicultural issues and just looking at your own neighborhood, perhaps, and how can you take some of these lessons and apply them in your own neighborhoods?
Yeah. One of the things they had me do in my stake was to help line up people who were willing to have an international student come have dinner with them sometime during the year. And that was an interesting experience. And I was kind of surprised at how difficult that was for some of the members of our stake to, you know, people that you'd think would have no problem inviting people to their home and have them say, you know, "I'm not sure I could do that. I've never done that before. That'd be really hard." I never thought of it as really hard, but...
I know I have had some opportunities for travel, and when I was in Holland, I stayed in a hotel, and the person that I was working with chewed me out for staying in the hotel. "You're supposed to be at my house. I'm a total stranger to you. You're supposed to be at my house. Next time you come, you're staying at my house."
You would have learned more. Yeah, isn't that amazing?
So every culture is different, and for some of us, it is a little bit more difficult to embrace some of these other differences, but I know that there are cultures out there that, hey, they embrace it wholeheartedly.
Well, we do too in lots of ways.
Yes, we do. We do. This is Insights on the Mormon Channel. We have with us today Professor Nick Eastman from the Department of Instructional Technology and Learning Sciences at Utah State University in Logan, Utah. Continuing on with this multicultural and how we can utilize that. However, you know, I talked about my own travels, and I have had the opportunity to travel to several different countries. And I've witnessed the truth of President Ezra Taft Benson's prophetic voice when he said that pride is the universal sin. And I have seen it in every culture. Every culture, including my own, struggles with pride. Do you think this is what causes the clash between cultures?
I think that the real basis for the clashes are fear. And it's a fear of somehow we won't measure up to what these people are able to do. They're different than we are. And we, instead of cooperating with them, somehow need to compete with them or to put them down. And so I think that there's just a human tendency to like to team up with people that are like you and be a bit repelled by people who you perceive to be somewhat different. And I think that if God had wanted to make us all the same, he could have, but he didn't. And I think part of what he had in mind was to get us to learn to get along and learn to enjoy people that are different than we are. And it's a maturation process. It takes time. But somehow you have to get over that basic fear. Because if the fear is there, you'll always be suspicious and you'll always be worried. And most of the time when I look at race prejudice, the basis of it really is fear. If you get down deep, that's where it is. I wish there was an easy solution because it isn't possible to just ignore that there are differences. You can't just say, well, we're all people. That'll be fine. Because sometimes there are unearned privileges that people have just based on their particular status in the society. And if it's never examined, things never change.
You quoted in that article a talk given by Elder Ballard who brings out the Savior's parable of the Good Samaritan. I've heard that particular parable referred to as difficult for a lot of cultures to live because everybody has that problem of, you know, you want me to associate with whom?
Yeah.
You know, and so it is a difficult problem. But I think the gospel has some good helps for us in overcoming that.
I do too. And in the parable of the Good Samaritan, be a great example because if Christ had wanted to make that another Jewish person that helped him out, he could have, but that wasn't the way that the story was said. It was the Samaritans that the Jews typically looked down on, and here was a person that stepped out of that precast role and performed something really marvelous. Just really a neat story. And I think there's a great example there of let's look at some of the other cultures and see what we can learn from those people and expect that they probably have some lessons they can teach us so we can learn from those. With this class that I was teaching, there was a kind of a key moment, maybe the second or third time I was teaching it, and I was talking about a program where some Americans had figured out a way to build some schools in Africa for, at the time, it was $10,000. And the students kind of looked at each other, and before the class was up, they said, you know, we think we could do that. Why don't we just make that a class project? Let's pull some money together, and let's see if we can't get a school funded. And I took in a deep breath and said, yeah, well, that would be exciting if you could make that work. And so that class worked, and they raised a couple $1,000s, which is not a, you know, that's a pretty remarkable thing considering everybody's finances. as students. And then another class took on the same project and raised another 1,000. And then the third class that heard about it took on the project, and they raised 4,000 some odd doing a walkathon that was fairly successful. But we were able to send the funds that we had gathered, and it was used to build a school in Africa. And I came away with a real strong belief that if you teach about the difficult things in the world and you don't give your students a chance to do something positive, that you are inviting them either to be cynical, so what's the difference? Things are terrible anyway, or apathetic, that it really doesn't matter, as opposed to being an activist and saying, you know, there's something I can do about that. Maybe I ought to. I ought to do something that would make a difference. And I remember one conversation with a African-American woman that came to our class, who was a member of the church and who was talking about some of the difficulties she'd faced. And somebody said, well, you know, I really have trouble striking up a conversation with somebody who's of a different race than I am. And she said, well, one of the things I've noticed is if you're working on a project together, let's say you're building a bridge, that seems to break down those barriers. You don't have any trouble having a conversation and striking up a friendship where you're working on something you both believe in. And in the classes I've taught, I've tried as much as possible to always have a service project that members of the class could participate in. And I say could because it would be something that would be their choice if they chose to participate. But if they did, lots of times there were some really neat possibilities. And we've done studies, evaluation studies, because a lot of my classes are about research and evaluation. And in this particular term, we're doing this project for the Toys R Us group and going to comment on their training and try and give them some feedback on what we think works and what doesn't that will be pretty useful to them. There's another one of the other classes, they have to propose a research project, and this one student has done a study of our local library and interviewed patrons as they exited the library. And so I think I'm sitting on that library board, and I think in our next meeting, if things go well, I'll be able to take the report that the student has done and take it in, and it will be useful to the library board in some of their deliberations. And this idea, for me, is such a dynamite idea, and it's just that the greatest underutilized resource on any college campus, and for that matter, any school, is the energy of the students. And if instead of just having them do exercises for the sake of exercises, you can put them on something that has social value, you can accomplish remarkable things. And I could point to some, I mean, the school that was built in Africa was pretty exciting, and one of the students got to go on an internship to that part of Africa and went out and toured and took pictures and brought them back and so forth. So I have seen the pictures, although I've never been to the place exactly. But another class built a bridge and a trail and some steps that opened up a new sector of campus to walking traffic here on campus.
So this service learning that you're talking about is that you're teaching principals in a classroom, and you have off over to the side over here a potential service project to present to them to allow them to either do it or not to do it that would support and help them perhaps more fully understand what it is that you're teaching. And then that also helps promote what's going on in the community.
Yeah.
That's a great idea.
Well, and it's not as hard to pull off as you might think. Sometimes the service can be actually for the class. With this online class, I could see that we needed to do some accommodation to make the videos available for people with a hearing impairment. And I recruited students, and this was an optional thing, but if they were willing to help transcribe one of the videos, we'd give them a reduced assignment in another area. And we had hours and hours of video that would have cost us a lot of money to get transcribed that the students actually did, and I think felt good about that they were helping make the class more accessible to handicapped people. But it also paid off for the other students, too, because if you wanted to see the transcript rather than listen to Eastman talk for 4 minutes, you could probably read it in two. So it opened up some other doors that way. But we have done reports for our department for accreditation. We've done projects where we were funded by an outside agency to do some work. We did about three studies for the, two studies for the State Library Division down in Salt Lake. And every one of those has been a fun thing, and sometimes they'll pay for it. And if they do, you put that into the scholarship fund, and that helps
somebody else
do something. So I just think it's a dynamite idea, and I'd like to see it used more.
Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us today. And I love that idea, too. I think if we could utilize that, not only in our classrooms, even at church, in our Sunday school classrooms and with our youth, wow, some powerful things could happen. So thank you for sharing that with us today. Thank you for listening to Insights on the Mormon Channel, the official media channel of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We invite our audience to visit mormonchannel.org to check out this and other programs. I'm Merrilee Stallings.